This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. We are proud to be the UK's number one legal consumer podcast. Our legal conversation today will be about divorce. What is not a matrimonial asset? I am joined by Senior Barrister Michael George from Three Paper Buildings Chambers in London. Michael is a specialist family practitioner with over 30 years experience, and he has a reputation for a good-humoured and robust forensic approach with careful analysis. He is also qualified to hear private financial dispute resolution hearings. In addition to his court work, Michael is a regular writer for professional journals and he lectures the profession on legal matters. Thank you so much for joining me today, Michael.
Good morning, Hattie, and it's nice to be back.
Divorce rates are up, and sadly, statistics show that over 42% of marriages in the UK end up in divorce. Whilst couples do not enter into a marriage expecting to get a divorce, well, not the majority, the confusion on who gets what, why, and the expense and stress that can come with getting a divorce can be very trying. I've been there myself, so I speak from personal experience. Statistics show that in a 12-month period, there were over 50,000 court cases with divorcing couples who are unable to agree between themselves on who should get what from the assets, left to the hands of a judge to decide. With many marriages taking place with couples well into their 30s, 40s and 50s plus, it is not unusual for individuals to enter into a marriage having acquired their own assets. But in the eyes of the law, is it the case that everything each person owns, including assets that they brought into the marriage, should be divided equally between the parties in a divorce? Can it be argued that assets that you brought into the marriage are not joint assets and that you should walk away with what you brought in? Or do our laws state that once you are married, everything that you both individually owned prior to the marriage becomes part of the matrimonial pot? In this episode, Michael and I will be discussing all of the above and much more, telling you what you need to know, together with our top tips, as always, in plain and simple English. Michael, can we start by briefly explaining, please, what is meant by a matrimonial asset? Because most people, most everyday people, have never even heard that term, even though they could have been married for decades, actually.
Well, Hattie, the basic definition is very, very simple. But like when lawyers get involved, simple definitions become more and more complicated. Simply put, a matrimonial asset is an asset which a couple have built up during the course of their marriage.
And that's the underlying point. During the marriage.
And sometimes, in sort of the old days, and we're going back well over 25 years before a case called White and White, a spouse would sue for maintenance and would try and get their reasonable needs. That's all changed. The contribution to a marriage is almost invariably treated as being equal. So if someone stays at home and one party goes out to work, that is still treated as the fruit of the marriage and something that falls to be shared. Some ways I explain it by saying it doesn't really matter who brings home the bacon and who cooks it. You still eat the same meal.
Oh, I love it. The fruits of the marriage, and it doesn't matter who brings home the bacon and who cooks it. I mean, can you give us an example of when an asset is not a matrimonial asset and why this would be the case? Because I've heard lawyers say that an asset acquired during the cohabitation period should also be considered as the matrimonial asset if the couple marry or enter afterwards into a civil partnership and then divorce?
Well, we've got two slightly different concepts going there. The first thing is generally cohabitation that leads seamlessly into marriage is treated as part of the marriage itself.
Very important. Let's just outline that. So what we're saying here is that if you've lived together for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and then you get married, the assets that you acquire during that period, which is called your cohabitation period, also are deemed as a matrimonial asset.
That's right. And cohabitation is an interesting concept. Many parties have, they live separately a lot of times. In fact, there's one case where a party didn't cohabit at all. But Mr. Justice Williams, as I recall, concluded that because they had trust and confidence in one another, they were living their lives with a common shared goal that was deemed to be akin to marriage. So to a certain extent, back to lawyers, cohabitation for lawyers doesn't necessarily mean the same as it means to everybody else. But crude, rough measure of it is really if you're cohabiting and it leads seamlessly into marriage, then that's all part of the same effort. And for many, many, many relationships, the difference is very much just a piece of paper, isn't it? You share your lives together,
yes.
You have joint commitment, and the courts recognize that. However, when you separate, the courts are pretty clear. It's a recent case called Waggett and Waggett. It says really the sharing principle ends on separation. It's not quite that straightforward. So You get a lot of marriages where someone will bring property or resources into a marriage, or a lot of cases where parties separate and a lot of assets are built up afterwards. I mean, the most famous case, it's a case called Vincent Wyatt. He's the owner of Ecotricity. When they separated, they owned little more than I think a secondhand caravan, and he went on become a very successful eco entrepreneur.
Well, I mean, when is an asset not a matrimonial asset? Let's try and why would that be the case? Let's give an example of that.
Well, a classic example would be the Vincent Wyatt case, where when they separated, they had virtually nothing. And then he went on to build a very, very successful business.
Well, they were still married, but separated.
No, totally separated, totally separate. So everything was built up post-separation.
So we're talking about when you enter the marriage. So you've entered a marriage, you've got your assets. And let's use a property as an example, because I think that is very, very common where people own a property of some form. They then meet somebody, they then cohabit, they then get married, then sadly the divorce comes into play. Is their property that they owned prior to marriage not a matrimonial asset or not? And I've got a view on this, but I just want to hear what your view is.
Well. It starts off as being not matrimonial. But if you share an asset, even if it's non-matrimonial origin, it can become treated as a matrimonial asset.
Indeed.
Sometimes we call it nuptialized or maritalized.
These are more long words for the legal system.
And you probably won't find them in the dictionary, but it explains the concept of how an asset can change in its nature. And one of the classics is the family home. And
yes,
the scenario is, one party has a house, the other party move in, they live in it. And generally, because a house forms a central part of most family lives, that is often treated as being matrimonial assets. However, that's not the end of the question. There are a few cases where the judges have turned around and gone, well, whilst we appreciate that originally these have been described as being matrimonial assets, you can depart from equality. But Hattie, the cases where that really happens is where you're talking about very high net worth individuals, where they have lots and lots and lots of money.
There's enough to go around.
And there's a lot to go around.
Yes.
And you make a very good point. You say enough to go around, because we can get very excited about matrimonial assets. But more importantly, you need to think about needs. And at the end of the day, if a party needs the assets, then they are going to be shared. And the vast majority of cases that we deal with by a day-to-day basis, and we talk about assets less than a few million pounds, are generally treated as needs-based cases. So parties get very, very exercised about matrimonial and non-matrimonial. But all too often, it gets trumped by this concept of needs. But I'll park that issue. But generally, you really need to be talking about more than a few million pounds of assets before you're talking about needs.
I think that's a really crucial point, Michael, and one that actually most people not even aware of. When I went through my divorce, gosh, how many years now? 18 years, 19 years ago, however long it was. I didn't even know the concept of needs. And what we're saying here for people to kind of understand and break it down a little bit more is a court will look at what are each person's needs. So everybody needs somewhere to live. So if you've come into your marriage, your relationship, first your relationship, and you own the property, then you get married, then you're going through a divorce and all you've got is that property. I've got a case on at the moment. I mentioned it just before we press record. Then the court's going to look at what does each person need? A home. There's only one home. We have to divide that home. And even though you may have brought that home into the marriage, the court's going to look at the needs of the parties. You both need somewhere to live. The equities in that home or that home needs to be sold so everybody can then have perhaps a smaller place to live or some money to be able to house themselves by way of rental income. Maybe they'll go and, you know, purchase a shared ownership property or be able to do something to house themselves. And I think that's actually a very key point on this topic, because as you quite rightly said, we all get hung up on what's a matrimonial asset and what's not. I've heard lawyers say, oh, it's not a matrimonial asset if it doesn't have a direct benefit to the couple, i.e., you own a property before you came into the marriage, you get married, that property is a rental property. It's rented out. So, and did you use the rental income to fund the shopping bills of your actual home or your mortgage or whatever it was? And if you didn't, then that can be excluded from being a matrimonial asset. But I'm with you on this. I think that it's got to be, and you're absolutely the case, that it's about needs really that determine what is going to be classified as a matrimonial asset or not.
Absolutely. I mean, let's deal with some clear examples and woolly examples. So a really clear example is if you inherit money after you separate, clearly non-matrimonial. If you inherit money during a marriage, but you don't share it, it stays in a separate account. Marked, you know, Hattie's inheritance, do not
touch. That's interesting. Yes.
That's fine. But if you then use that inheritance money to, say, pay down your mortgage, then it becomes maritalized or nuptialized. The other aspect about it is sometimes, very often, people inherit a family business.
Yes.
And, of course, that gets sort of murky. But if you look at a case where someone comes into a marriage with the family business, then what you tend to look at is the growth of that business during the marriage. So say it's worth 2 million when you get together and it's worth 5 million when you separate, then 3 million of that value is matrimonial asset. And then the other 2 million is a financial resource. It's non-matrimonial, a financial resource that's available to meet need.
Very interesting.
And I think it's also very important. So even the clearest of non-matrimonial assets, let's go back to my example of inheritance received after someone dies, of parties separate, I'm sorry. That is still a resource available to meet need. So imagine you've got a family that are worth of absolutely nothing, but they inherit a nice lot of money just after separation, and both parties need to provide a home for the kids, then that inheritance is non-matrimonial, but it's still a resource available to meet need. And it will be looked at very carefully.
Very interesting, because obviously what we're saying here after separation is when you actually separate and still going through your divorce, you haven't had the financial remedy. You haven't come to an agreement on the finances of your marriage. And I tell you, we have got lots of podcasts on divorce. And I always say there's two aspects to the divorce. There's one, the divorce itself, we are no longer married. And then there's actually dealing with who gets what from the marriage, agreeing that the best way to do it is between yourselves. are failing that, obviously, lawyers are there to assist. But that is the most fundamentally, the most important part of getting a divorce. And it's what Michael's saying is when you separate, so the date of the separation is when actually things don't come into the pot as a matrimonial asset necessarily. However, anything that does, and we've given the inheritance point as a very good example here, could come into the pot to meet the needs of the parties.
Indeed, indeed. And Hattie, what we do about the, of course, again, we're dealing with law and it's all very discretionary. Just when a
Yes.
marriage ends and you receive an asset after it's ended, doesn't stop it from being necessarily matrimonial. Think of an example of a bonus. And you do all the work over a year and you get the bonus just at the end of that year. If that work has been done during the marriage, but the bonus is received after the marriage,
That's very interesting.
very much treated as matrimonial property. And the longest the jargon is runoff very often. And the longest one I did was about a 10-year runoff where I think the husband in that case was doing deals on property, but wasn't going to get the money out of it for about 10 years
Until the end.
till it came for it. And that's all matrimonial property and it all gets divided. That's a very extreme
Spec
example.
Yeah, and that's speculatively divided because you have to then say, right, you're going to get your bonus at the end of the 12 months. I'm happy to do a deal now, but we expect that to be X pounds. Let's bring that into the pot and look at how that looks like when we're coming to divide the assets of our marriage on who gets what and why. I mean, one of the points that is argued a lot in divorce is what is considered a long marriage. So people that get married later on in life and they've got assets, for example, they've been married 4 years, 7 years plus. I've been in a courtroom, Michael, where I've heard a judge say, where I've heard a judge say, 7 years is just probably about a long marriage. And I've heard a judge say, no, I don't think that's a long marriage. What's your experience on that?
Well, strictly speaking, I think it's a judgment by Mr. Justice Mostyn, who took a look at the New York court, New York Code, which defined a long marriage as being 20 years. However, that's a bit of American law, and Mr. Justice Mostyn is very good at looking around the world for some proper codified rules on it. In practice, it's up to the judge. Certainly, less than 2 years is defined as a short marriage. 7 years, I would generally call that a medium marriage.
Yes, I'd say.
Some judge would call it medium longish in that regard. And over 7 years, you're getting into some, the long marriage territory. And of course, you asked the question because it's really quite important. The longer the marriage, the less important the origin of the money is, and the stronger the sharing principle. So imagine my scenario of, you inherit money, but you inherit money before the marriage, and it stays in an account mentioned, marked Hattie's inheritance not to be shared, etc.
That would have been nice.
Wouldn't that be lovely? You and I managed to stay married for 35 years or so. Then very much that's going to be treated as a resource after 35 years of marriage.
Yes.
However, if we were to separate after, say, 30 months rather than 30 years, then often the attitude is very much, you wrung what you brung, so to speak. You walk
I
away,
like that.
you walk away with what you brought to the marriage. Having said that, of course, needs are an important aspect. Because one of the realities, the practical aspects, is the longer the people are married, the more their finances become intertwined. Very often, you're more likely to have children, not necessarily, of course. But that often means that the intermingling happens on a practical level rather than a theoretical one. But certainly, you're going to get a more generous interpretation of your needs after a long marriage than a short marriage.
And that's so interesting because I hear over a decade I've been practicing the law, and the amount of times I've heard mainly women who come to the table and say, I'm not entitled to anything, yes, I've been a housewife. That's what he's told me. Do I get a roof over my head? We've been married for 25 years plus. I don't have a career. I gave up my career to have the children and to raise the children, How can I possibly earn what he's earning to give myself the same lifestyle? What do I get? What am I entitled to? Because he's telling me, because he went out to work and he brought the bacon home, and you made a very, very good comment earlier, and she necessarily fried it, so to speak, that she's not entitled because she didn't bring that asset in even during the marriage. So I think one of the headlines here for people to really take away is everything in the pot, the starting point is, if it's a long marriage, it goes into the pot. It's up to the other side, whether it's your husband or your wife, to argue why it shouldn't be in that pot. Because the court, if you end up in court and you can't agree amongst yourselves, is going to look at who needs what and why.
Yeah, I mean, the Court of Appeal explained it quite neatly in a case called K&L. And they said in that, well, matrimonial property, the sharing principle applies, starts at 50-50, and you need to argue why it shouldn't be a departure from that on needs. On non-matrimonial property, it starts at 0-100, and you need to argue why you need to have
Why it
some of that
is.
non-matrimonial property. And it's quite a good way of looking at it. Of course, the courts also recognize, what is quasi-matrimonial property, because in family life, in real life, the areas are often a bit blurred around the edges,
Yes.
and they can have elements of matrimonial and non-matrimonial aspects to it. And we have to work our way through. And this is why it's very, very hard to be formulaic in the outcome of a divorce. Every life is different, every marriage is
Yes.
different, and every financial setup is different.
It is, absolutely. And I just say, if ever, ever in doubt, then do take some advice, at least to try and get your head around what your specific position is and why it is like that.
But had you coming back to the old concept of, just because the traditional man went out to earn the money and the
Yes.
traditional wife stood back and stayed at home, all that gets shared equally. The irony of it, though, is you get some spouses who work incredibly hard and some spouses are incredibly feckless. And I mean, I did a case a while ago where, refreshingly, it was the woman that made the money, in fact, and she set up a very good business, did well on that. The child, they had a child, and she did well on that. And she raised that child, did a good job. The husband sort of went off to the Caribbean and started a dive business that didn't do very much, and then came back and started looking at cars and didn't do very much on that, and really didn't contribute much financially or socially to the marriage. But he rather got half. And
Goodness gracious.
the difficulty about it is you can be a hardworking spouse, or really quite a look at your trophy spouse, the one that doesn't do very much at all and doesn't really contribute. But those contributions are recognized as equal. And the courts are not going to get involved
This is
in
it. I mean, do honestly,
distributing
like
value.
stripping back all the legal stuff from it, do we actually think that's fair? Because I have to sit here and I would say that's not fair. In the example that you just explained, I cannot for one moment sit here and say that spouse, that husband who didn't contribute, as you quite nicely said, socially or financially to the marriage, how on earth does the law say, well, he should get 50% of everything? How is that justified?
I think at the end of the day, there are going to be injustices in any basic principle. But if you start to scratch behind domestic contribution and what it's worth, then you begin to get inherently discriminatory in terms of gender. And I think that's the problem. And so a very firm policy decision has been made to equate domestic contribution to financial contribution, for want of a better term, and the courts and the judges are not going to get involved in looking at the minutiae of it. And I think the judges are very sensible, in that there are phrases like, we're not going to get involved in rummaging through the attic. And it's not the court's role to adjudicate on the validity of a marriage.
Yes.
There's been a relatively recent case called E&L where they looked at childless marriages and whether and there
Because
was
needs change, needs
Well, the needs
massively
change.
change.
Needs change. But also, there was some thoughts in some quarters that maybe you look at the contribution slightly differently in the context of a childless marriage or a non-childless marriage. Now
Interesting.
that has been put thoroughly to bed, that concept. And all marriages are to be treated the same, either with or without children, in that regard. And the principles, of course, are the same, but they're applied slightly differently, as I said earlier, the intermingling, the needs, and those sorts of concepts. But every marriage is as valid as the next one.
And we said it earlier, and I say it all the time, every marriage and every divorce is so different. Even if you think on the outskirts, well, we own just one property or just this or just that. It's your ages. It's how old you are. It's your earning capacity. It's your health. It's what are you know, what do you need? What does each party need? Why? Contributions can come into it if it's not a long marriage. The length of the marriage. So many things have to be taken into consideration. And this is why I say, as much as I like to say, look, these podcasts are for people to listen to and get an idea and get some information that's in plain and simple English for people to understand. But honestly, at least take a very basic level of legal advice, initial level of legal advice, to know where you potentially stand. Because whatever you come out with from a marriage will financially affect you for the rest of your life. Period.
Absolutely. And I think particularly in this country, we're very keen in having tailor-made solutions that deal with the nuances of every single marriage. And that means that every case is different and every case can have a slightly different outcome. And you know what it's like, Katie, you're advising people. They go, oh, well, you know, I went down the pub last week and they got 50-50 and why can't I get that? Or, you know,
She took everything. She took me to the cleaners. I've heard it as well as you have, honestly, Michael.
But also, I mean, everything is really quite nuanced. I was discussing matters at a conference with a Dutch colleague, and in Holland, it's a very, very formulaic system. And their approach on that is said, well, you know, there will be unfairness in many, many cases that we do, but you know where you stand. And we look at that as being more important than having your tailor-made solution where
one size is not going to fit all.
One size fits all. But I suppose drawing it together, I suppose the watchwords on this are this. But first, needs trump sharing. So if you've got a needs-based case, the matrimonial property concept are going to be purely academic and no one's going to get too involved. That's the first aspect to it. The second aspect of it is the non-matrimonial property is always a resource available to meet need.
It can become into the pot, not necessarily because it was a matrimonial asset, but to meet the needs of the parties. Absolutely. Like the money example we gave.
Indeed. And also assets that have been shared are generally, during the marriage, are generally treated as matrimonial. But you can get a departure from equality to recognise that. But you're looking at pretty high value and rather exotic cases rather than the ones that we deal with 95% of the time, you know, in relation to it.
Yes, no, indeed.
Indeed. And the other point is, of course, you know, non-matrimonial property can be assets you receive, you bring into a marriage that you acquire during a marriage, such as inheritance, but also post-separation. And post-separation income is generally looked at as a resource which is available to meet need, but it's not one to be shared. And one of the aspects about it is there's no right to share in earning capacity. So when you have a long marriage and one party has, for instance, given up their career to support...
Which is very, very common.
Save in very, very rare cases, there's no compensation for that. There is a concept of compensation, but it's as, you know, rare as the snow leopard, as we say.
I think one of the things, the very simple things, and again, I must have said this a million times over the last decade, is when you divide one, it's never going to equal one. So for all those that feel that they have had to give, or they've been hard done by, and the divorce took from them, and you know the inheritance had to come in and to be divided to meet the needs of the parties, and that was their inheritance and nothing to do with the marriage, or something the house they had before they came into the marriage. You've got to understand that one is what you become upon marriage. That's in the eyes of the law, and when you go your separate ways, it will never equals one.
Indeed, but Mahati, one thing you can do with inheritance is if you're going to receive it, you can either get it put in a trust to protect that asset, or you can enter a what we call postnuptial settlements.
Yes, postnups and prenups and postnups. But I'm going to write the trust down. We're going to do an episode on trusts, you and I, Michael, because I've just thought we haven't done an episode on that. And I think it'd be very interesting for us to talk about what happens to an asset when you put it in a trust and you're going through a divorce, and at what point and how. So if you're up for it, I've already put your name against that one.
There we go. Well, listen to this space and you'll hear all about trusts in a couple of months' time.
Yes, hopefully. Michael, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. And good to see you again, Hattie.
Thank you. And I'll say to our listeners, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. We have over 160 to choose from. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.